Hi everyone. We're going to have our normal show this week because we do want to give you something to maybe help with your mental state a little bit. But know that right now, as we record this in the US and around the world, there are protests for justice. And we would like to say from us to all of you out there that we believe Black Lives Matter and we do stand with everyone protesting for justice right now. We know this is a difficult time and we know that everybody needs sometimes to take a moment, take a step back. The world can't be on your shoulders all of the time. So, if you would like, for the next few minutes or for the entirety of the episode, whatever you need, we're going to try to ease that load just a little bit. We stand with you and we hope that justice will be done. Thanks.
And now, our feature presentation.
I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday.
Oh, today is going to be a really, really fun one. A really fun movie that... Oh, I forgot how fun this movie is. We are talking about Meet the Robinsons.
We're going to the future, y'all!
Yeah, this is definitely taking place in that experimental era of Disney. Like, the Renaissance had been done. They were trying something new. We weren't quite ready for the modern era yet of Disney. This revival era that we're in. That experimental era, which is honestly 50-50 depending on which movie you're watching.
That is true.
And we're not alone for this one.
We're not. Would our mystery guest enter and sign in, please?
Hi, my name is Gilbert, and I'm a celebrity impression. You may know me as Iago from Aladdin, but not really. Because this is Luke Ski. How you doing, everybody?
Hi, Luke.
Hey, Luke.
Luke wraps up our Magisword trifecta.
Yes, the last of our good Magisword friends.
And thus ends up all the people we know in the animation industry.
That is also true. Luke, would you like to tell the good people what you did on Magiswords?
Well, Kyle, thanks to the kindness of him, got me the opportunity to start off on the show as a storyboard revisionist, and then after the 5-minute web shorts were finished up. I got promoted when it started the television version to storyboard artist. So I got to be one of the storyboard artists, one of four teams. So I ended up with a partner storyboarding about 25% of the episodes. And also I was able to do voices on the show. So I voiced a handful of the tertiary characters and miscellaneous, random background characters. Also on about 25% of the episodes, just not always the same 25%. So there's bits of me all over the place on Magiswords. And now that it's on HBO Max, I've been rewatching it again while I've been working on other things, just so that their algorithms can know that people are watching it.
HBO Max. Yeah, that was the thing between the last episode and this one. HBO Max launched.
Yeah,
in the streaming wars.
Yeah, HBO Max, the kind of Warner Brothers, is it, version Warner of Disney Plus? Yeah,
because Warner Brothers owns HBO, so it's Warner Brothers, HBO, the Turner empire of shows, and then...
Cartoon Network, right?
Yeah, that includes Cartoon Network, and they had announced a long time ago that there was going to be like a bunch of throwback shows, as they call them, from Cartoon Network on HBO Max, but they hadn't really announced a lot of what those were, and of course they mentioned the big gun names of the current you know, era popular shows like Adventure Time and Steven Universe, because they're trying to promote the thing. So the day it launched, myself and Kyle and Lindsay and everybody else were thoroughly surprised and pleased to see that out of the that there were, because I actually went through and counted, there are 19 franchises from Cartoon Network on HBO Max, and one of them is Mighty Magiswords, the first two TV seasons. So we were just kind of blown away just thinking about all of the other amazing shows from the Cartoon Network, you know, library history that haven't made it onto HBO Max yet, but they chose us to be one of the launch series. So that you know, made us really happy. I'm sure those other shows will show up soon, because the way most of these streaming networks work is that they don't put everything on at launch. They, you know, kind of pare things out over time. So
they need you to keep coming back, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, but man, it just, we were so happy to find that out.
Yeah, in the
let me know when Megas XLR gets on there. We'll talk.
In the one non-Disney show we constantly plug on this show, Mighty Magiswords, on Hulu, HBO Max, iTunes, and Amazon Prime, I believe you can find it through those services.
Anywhere where you can buy seasons of a TV show, it's probably there.
Yeah.
Also on YouTube and Google Play.
Yes, also on YouTube and Google Play. Yeah, it's around a lot of places. Go watch it. It's a great show. Also, in things we need to plug that Luke is somehow involved in, we mentioned it last week, but we've got the Logan Awards coming up, the Comedy Music Awards. We still need you to go to loganawards.com and give us your nominations,
your
open nominations. Yeah, give us your top five songs or music, comedy music videos of 2019. I am fortunate enough to be a juror this year, so I want to hear all of the cool things you heard in 2019, and we will pick the best.
We've actually won a few Logan Awards over the years.
Yes. Want to talk about the Logan Awards, Luke?
Oh, I've won three, you know.
Not to brag.
That really means the world to me that I have. This has been going on since we started in 2011 with the songs that each year is doing the songs of the previous calendar year. So, you know, so this year will be... It'll be our 10th year of doing the Logan Awards, so 2010 through 2019. One of the major differences for this year that you already mentioned, due to the way the new version of way we are accepting suggestions for nominations, when you make your suggestion, you have to suggest a total of five things. You can't just suggest one or two, and you can't suggest more than five. The number of the nomination suggesting shall be five. So basically, if you want to go through the comedy music that you listen to, the videos you watch, and just, you know, start making, jotting down a little list of the things from the year 2019 that you'd like the best, and then you can go to loganawards.com and fill out the form, and it's, you know, they're going to want the name of the song, who it's by, and a link to that song, either, you know, the YouTube video link or the Bandcamp, you know, link to the song or whatever.
SoundCloud,
it is.
Whatever.
Yeah. So just submit your five, and then it'll go on to the next step, and jurors like Zakiki will be reviewing them all and picking what'll end up being eventually the five actual nominations, and then one of those will win, and then we will have the Logan Awards ceremony, which brings us to the next thing. Which is FumpFest 2020, which originally was going to be a live event happening the weekend of August 29th, but FumpFest 2020 has been canceled. We have been the live event. We have already made a set up FumpFest 2021 for August of 2021 with the hotel and with guest of honor Dr. Demento. And what we're doing instead is we're going to have a FumpFest at Home event. So officially FumpFest 2020 will be an online event that'll be happening on August 29th. The details of how exactly that's going to go are still being worked out, but our intention right now is the live streaming event, which will be totally free. We'll have some live concerts. It'll have our Fump Music video contest for that fans can enter. We're going to have the Dumb Parody Ideas contest, which people can enter by sending videos ahead of time of them performing their Dumb Parody Idea songs. We are going to have the Logan Awards ceremony as a part of the live stream, showing the music videos. I'm not sure if we're going to have the full live performances in that or not. And Devo's in the process of figuring out who our performers will be for that evening. So it'll be whenever you turn on a microphone to record a podcast with me, I immediately start yawning at random points. That's nothing to do with this show. It's on all three of my other podcasts. It'll be like a 4 or 5 hour thing happening on the evening of August 29th. So just follow the Fump on Twitter or go to our Facebook page. On Twitter, it's at the Fump, THEFUMP, and go to thefump.com. You can find how to follow us and stay on top of the forthcoming announcements. But mark your calendar, August 29th, for Fump Fest at Home, and it'll be nifty.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, would you like to know the fun story of this year? This year, Fump Fest was supposed to start on my birthday. It was my birthday plan for this year, and I was going to be a juror at the Logan Awards, which was going to be really fun. And then 2020 happened, and 2020 is the worst.
By the way, how are you enjoying the Snyder Cut of 2020?
Oh!
I do not enjoy the Snyder Cut of anything.
Can we just fast forward to 2021?
Well, I think we should fast forward a little farther than that. Say we go to the future now? Enough of this nonsense in 2020. Yeah.
2020, let's go to the year. I believe, according to this, the movie is set in the year 2037. Which, this movie came out in 2007, so that is about 30 years into the future, and we are considerably shorter to that point. We're closer to the future of this movie than we were when the movie came out.
That is how linear time works. Congratulations.
Yes. So, let's talk about Meet the Robinsons, 2007 Disney movie. Again, this was during that experimental era. We had there was a lot of movies that came out. You know, we talked about Lilo and Stitch in a previous episode. And you had other movies like Treasure Planet, Home on the Range, Chicken Little. Again, it's depending on which movie you're watching. And I would consider Meet the Robinsons kind of a hidden gem because it came out during that time where people were really not respecting Disney as a company. Pixar was there and DreamWorks were kind of taking over that attention from Disney.
Yeah, they were, you know, it was this, you know, period of transition, and the movie Home on the Range was the, you know, not, of course, you know, Princess and the Frog is another story, but, you know, Home on the Range was basically the last of the hand-drawn animated features they made, and it was, you know, kind of a nail in the coffin sort of thing, but people... You need to realize the timeline of how animated features are made. It's like Home on the Range came out, I believe. I'm actually pulling up the Wikipedia page because I want to make sure I get this information correct. Back further. 2004 is what I want to say. Yep, 2004 was the year Home on the Range came out. And there's about a 3 to 4 year span of time that it takes to create an animated feature. So that means... September 11th happened right when Home on the Range was starting. I think that might have affected it. I know this is just my own theory, it's like there's that whole part in the middle of Home on the Range where it gets really sad. Like rain starts coming down and there's a huge flood and there's a whole, like a super sad song in the middle of this goofy talking cow movie.
And so, we kind of talked how September 11th kind of affected Lilo and Stitch. Their entire third act had to get changed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That, yeah, of course. But so, yeah, so you look at, you know, it's like Home on the Range, Chicken Little, Meet the Robinsons, Bolt, and then Princess and the Frog. So yeah, it's like there's a lot. I'm a very, for those of you who are unfamiliar with me, I'm a very silver lining type of person when it comes to my entertainment. And also, Walt Disney Animation Studios is my favorite animation studio. Probably my favorite, you know, movie studio, period. But so you know, I tend to cut them a lot of slack. So there's a lot of stuff in Home on the Range that I enjoy, and, you know, I think it's one of the best villain songs, the yodeling cow song there. And then, so yeah, Home on the Range, and then Chicken Little. I mean, that was definitely them trying to figure out what they are doing now. And you know, there's still a lot of fun in that, but it was, you know, a weird thing. And then they go to Meet the Robinsons after that. And then following that was Bolt. So Meet the Robinsons, which was based on a children's book.
Yep.
And I haven't read the children's book, but Bowler Hat Guy isn't even in the book.
yes, that would be A Day with Wilbur Robinson by William Joyce, who might be best well known as the guy that does the covers for The New Yorker. And that art is all over that book. So, and yeah, it's like a little 20-page kids book that they expanded into a 90-minute movie. It's very similar, I would say, to a movie that came out a year later, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, as the entire book makes a very short amount of this movie, and then it gets made up the rest.
Yeah, didn't you tell me that the entire plot of the book is just looking for the grandfather's teeth? Portion of the movie is the entire book?
The plot is Lewis goes to see his best friend, Wilbur Robinson, and then meets his entire family, and then gets caught up in this thing where they have to find the grandpa's teeth. That is where the book starts, and when they find the teeth is where the book ends. And that's about 10 minutes of this movie.
and you compared to, or you mentioned Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. It, to me, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs is less about them trying to tell the story of that book, and more like they just saw the concept of food as weather being a funny thing. So it's like, well,
yeah, how many puns can we make out of food and weather?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was more like about we're buying the rights to the book basically based on the general concept and using the title because people have heard of that title before. Because if we don't use that title, people are going to be like, hey, you're just ripping off Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. It's like, all right, well, we're just buying the rights and we're naming the movie that so y'all can shut up and enjoy our wacky weather food film.
And this movie was almost called A Day with Wilbur Robinson, and they kind of changed the title. And I could see why a lot of people slept on this, considering a different movie with the same similar title came out, Meet the Parents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can tell we're going to jump on that trend or something. So that is initially my initial reaction, and I never saw this movie in the theater. I did see this movie when it came on television, and I knew a little bit of the movie because, Luke, you wrote a song about this movie.
Yes. I saw the movie, and also one of my best friends in the world, Stephanie Wilde, who is my ex-wife, she also saw the movie, and we just both really connected with this movie on a personal level, and her even more so, because both of her parents passed away. Well, her father passed away when she was really young, and her mother passed away about a couple years before I met her, and her older brother is adopted, and just the whole theme of adoption and trying to find your family and find who you are really connected with her, and the whole theme of keep moving forward and everything, you know, really, you know, but you know, was we were both at a time in our lives where we were trying to figure out what was going on with us and what we were doing next, because we had been together, we had split up, we were both trying to figure out where we were going, what we were doing, And it just, it really resonated with both of us so strong. And especially at the end when they bring up the title of that, you know, extended quote from Walt Disney, and then they pull the rest of the quote away to show that the words "keep moving forward" were in that quote, and that that was a Disney quote. And like that,
nice, yes, it was a nice nod, honestly. I would admit that was a nice nod. You know, of course, you know, let's not forget the fact that the main character is a blonde kid that makes, that creates things.
Yeah.
That had to hit to you.
And his best friend is kind of a raging egomaniac as well. So, so
if you know Luke, you understand why I'm saying that. This is also the first movie after the Pixar buyout. When Iger bought Pixar for Disney, and John Lasseter jumps on and he becomes the new head of Walt Disney Animation.
Yeah.
And I think that's all we can really say about Lasseter, considering all the stuff that's happened with Lasseter.
Yeah. I will say, interestingly, this was the first directorial outing for the director of this film and one of the main voice actors on it. And the interesting thing is that he had been with Disney for a little while. Mm-hmm. He had been a storyboard artist on Tarzan, and he had done a movie we may get to eventually called The Emperor's New Groove, he had been a supervisor and did some voice work on that. But he also worked with on Brother Bear, and then right after Meet the Robinsons, he would go on to work on Bolt and Tangled and Winnie the Pooh and Frozen, and yeah. So he's all over Disney.
He's also a Facebook friend of mine now.
Really? Dang, we could have had him on the show.
So at the very least, I'm going to be telling him about this episode when it posts. So hi, Steve. Hi.
We can use connections. We have connections now.
He's also from Georgia, but unlike me, he escaped. Darn him.
So, briefly, Steve Anderson, because this has nothing to do with the, TV's Kyle Animation connections. This was long before that. I managed to, find him online and sent off a message to him on behalf of myself and Stephanie, and just kind of, this was like probably a good year or two after the movie had come out, and we just, when we wanted to let him know like how much the movie meant to us, and he got back to me, and it was cool to have, gotten that message to him and gotten a response from him, and then eventually, just because of the way Facebook works, he and I became Facebook friends. And so, I'm not trying to sit here and pretend like, yeah, we're best buddies and we go golfing and blah, blah, blah. It's like, but it's cool when there's somebody out there creating something and you reach out to them, and not only do they respond, but they're like really nice to you. It's like, that's super cool. I also wanted to mention, going back to the whole how much this movie meant to me, cosplay is a big sign of when something means something to somebody. I dressed up as Bowler Hat Guy for Halloween 1 year, and then later on when myself and my second wife, Sarah, went to Disney World for Halloween, I was dressed as Bowler Hat Guy on Disney property on Halloween night. I actually got pictures of me in front of the Carousel of Progress being all like and stuff like that. So that was, super cool, super epic. And I'll say what, because I want to get on to the actual movie, but he directed the 2011 the 2011 animated, hand-drawn animated Winnie the Pooh movie. That came out the weekend of, I can't remember if that year it was, I think it was Orlando Nerd Fest, one of the big nerdcore music festivals that I was performing at. And I actually figured out how to take the bus, the city transportation from from the Orlando Airport Marriott all the way to downtown Disney, so I could see the premiere of a Walt Disney Animation Studios movie on Disney property on the day it came out. And the interesting thing was, Disney decided for some reason to release that movie on the same day as the last Harry Potter movie. Because, you know, that was smart. And that night, after I saw the movie and got back, by the way, saw the movie, it was great fun. Lots of parents and kids in the theater laughing so much. There was a definite laugh out loud moment in that movie that I didn't see coming, and I'm not going to say what it is. I don't want to spoil for anybody, but 2011 Winnie the Pooh, good, go see it. But we got back to the concert that night, and Schaefer the Dark Lord was performing on stage with, I forgot who he was performing with, but they were doing a song that had to do with Harry Potter, and the intro is like, yeah, doing a song about some movie that might have come out today, and I shouted, Winnie the Pooh! Mm-hmm. And Schaefer goes, yes, this is our Winnie the Pooh song.
Anyway. Schaefer's a good dude.
Yeah, yeah. So much love to Steve Anderson and yes, Emperor's New Groove. Holy crap, one of my favorite movies of all time. Anyway, but enough about that. Let's talk about Meet the Robinsons from 2007, which is epic and awesome.
Of course, for those of you who don't get the joke, there's a song in the Carousel of Progress called Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow, which is in this movie, which is why Luke took the picture in front of the Carousel of Progress.
Yes, and the soundtrack, it's a version, cover version of that song done by They Might Be Giants, yeah. Which is just so epic.
They Might Be Giants is the best. Go listen to them.
Yeah, and the whole notion of the concept of It's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow from Carousel of Progress is basically what this movie's about, or at least on one level.
My favorite joke in the movie is when they first get to the future and they fly through and it says World of Today.
Oh, yeah. Today Land.
You're right. I did like that joke. That was a good Disney joke.
You see Space Mountain. You see the orbiter, the astro orbiter, and the sign that says Today Land.
Meet the Robinsons had a better, clearer, more obvious shot of Space Mountain than the movie Tomorrowland.
That is true. That is very, very accurate.
To find Space Mountain in Tomorrowland, you gotta be paying really close attention into one specific scene and have a good pause button for your Blu-ray or whatever to be like, there, way off there in the background. That's the thing that this movie should be about.
All right, let's talk about our cast. We do that on this show. We talk about the cast. Kiki, let's go through the cast.
Time to geek out about voice actors.
That should be a jingle for us.
Yes, we need a jingle for that.
The main character... Jordan Fry as Lewis, no last name.
Lewis, no last name. You will probably know him best as Mike TV in the film Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Tim Burton. The Johnny Depp one, right?
Yeah, the Johnny Depp one by Tim Burton. He is Mike TV in that one. That and this are kind of his two big claim to fame. For his acting career so far.
All right, and Tom Selleck as Cornelius Robinson, the father of the other main character.
Yeah, Magnum PI. Come on, who doesn't know Tom Selleck?
That is probably the funniest joke in this movie.
What does he look like, Tom Selleck?
And it's a picture of Tom Selleck.
And then he looks nothing like Tom Selleck, which I think is a better joke. That he sounds like Tom Selleck, but he looks absolutely nothing like Tom Selleck.
And the great thing is the image of Tom Selleck isn't just a photo. It's like they did a wonderfully painted picture of Tom Selleck.
Yeah, it's like a beautiful oil portrait of Tom Selleck that they do. I did like that.
Yeah, apparently the Tom Selleck joke was already in the script, and they kind of got Tom Selleck at the last minute to do Cornelius.
Yeah, from what I heard, it was like they had to I don't want to say this in a way that spoils anything, but yeah, they explained to Tom Selleck like what the idea was behind him being this voice and and also mentioning, you know, him, the celebrity by name was, and, you know, Tom thought that was really cool, and that's, he was like, yeah, I'll do it, so.
Yeah. We spoil everything on this show. This is a rewatch show. We assume they have watched the film. So
okay.
Spoiler away.
For almost 20-year-old movie.
Yeah.
Spoiler, he has a big head and little arms, and
this podcast is not very thought through.
Yeah.
Manager. That part at least I'll agree with.
All right, let's move on. Wesley Singerman as the other main character, Wilbur Robinson.
Yeah, his other big role was he has been Charlie Brown in several Charlie Brown specials in recent years. The modern ones, not the old ones. But in 2002, 2003, he did the voice of Charlie Brown in several shorts. He left voice acting after Meet the Robinsons to go be a music producer and guitarist. He has worked with the likes of Kendrick Lamar and Ty Dolla Sign as a producer, songwriter, guitar player. He says one day he's going to come back to voice acting, but so far that has not happened.
Well, he's waiting for the right role.
That's fine. I'm all for that.
The beauty about this, if you watch the original trailer for this movie, Wilbur's voice is much higher than it is in the actual movie. So I assume Wesley's voice changed at some point, and he had to re-record the entire movie.
He honestly is. I was thinking about this. He honestly is the most adult-sounding little kid in this whole movie.
Yeah.
Like, Wilbur really does sound like an adult trying to do a kid voice rather than a kid.
It worked for the character, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, because it does give him a little bit of gravitas that you're like, why would Lewis go with this, like, random weird kid? But, you know.
Steve Anderson as our villain, bowler hat guy.
Yes!
Also as Grandpa Bud and Cousin Tallulah.
Yep.
Young Goob, young bowler hat guy, is played by Matthew Johnston. I don't really know anything about him.
He doesn't have a Wikipedia page, so I assume this is his only role.
It might be. Let's see. He's done a lot of other stuff, but it seems more that he's a background character actor on live action more often than he does voice work.
And I think, if I remember correctly, the little, it's not really a speech, but he's just talking to he's talking to Lewis at the beginning of the movie while Lewis is building his invention and just kind of rambling, like talking about how much he loves baseball and stuff. I'm pretty sure that was improvised, which is just great.
That would be cool if so. I love when I love when films use just random bits of improv by the voice actors.
I mean, it could be anything. It's like, hey, you know, hey, Matt, what do you like about baseball? Oh, I like this, and this. Record that.
Yeah. All right, moving on.
Harlan Williams as Carl the Robot.
Yeah, Harlan Williams, good actor, comedian. You know him from, you know, tons of random stuff.
He was one of those comedians that, it's like they were prepping him to take off and be like the next, I don't know if Jim Carrey is the right word to go with, but like, you know, he was going to be like the next big comedy thing, like, you know, or whatever. And like, he made that movie Rocket Man there's nothing bad about him in any, you know, in any capacity. It's just that America just didn't hook into that. So Harlan didn't become like the household name. That
would be a completely different Rocket Man than
the Disney movie we might get to one day.
Yeah. No, this is the Disney movie, not the Elton John biopic.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got to give him credit for something. So okay, there was the movie made for theaters, remake of the Dukes of Hazzard, and in that movie, the Roscoe P. Cotrane was played. I forgot the actor's name, but you know. This big, imposing, like, you know, very threatening, you know, dude was like Ross, and it's like, wrong. That is so wrong. Even for me, this is just wrong. And then they made I think it might have been a prequel or something that was direct-to-video for this Dukes of Hazzard franchise with completely different actors in all the parts. And they cast Harlan Williams to be Roscoe P. Coltrane in that, and they even gave him a Basset Hound, and he was perfect! He was perfect! It's like, yes, this is the Roscoe P. Coltrane I came here for. Let's get him Flash! You know, it's like, he was great. So, anyway.
Yeah, we don't want to make it seem like Harlan Williams hasn't had a good and steady career. He especially has become mostly a voice actor in recent years. And he's done, you know, little bits on things like Robot Chicken and everything. But interestingly, the most recent thing he did was the Addams Family animated movie. He did a couple of voices in there.
Yeah, highly recommend that film. So good.
A running gag on this show has been Snoop Dogg as Cousin It.
Yeah.
Honestly,
I kind of loved Snoop Dogg as Cousin It. I didn't like the movie so much, but we won't get into that now.
It's not a Disney movie. We don't have to talk about it.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Probably one of the better, more well-known names in this movie, Nicole Sullivan as Franny Robinson, Wilbur's mother.
Yeah, yeah. Nicole Sullivan.
Mad TV.
On Mad TV. Then she went on to do King of Queens and all. But most lately, she's been, again, doing a lot of voice acting. I've run into her voice on some really interesting things. She did a voice in the Kim Possible. You know, we talked about her there, I believe, because she's Shego.
Yep.
So we've discussed her before. She does some other random Disney stuff like Sweet Life of Zack and Cody and, you know, some of the Disney Channel things. But, you know, she's always fun when she shows up, and I always love hearing her voice. And we talked last week about Sean Gimbroni being on the new Harley Quinn. So is Nicole Sullivan. She is actually plays his mother in that. She's Mrs. Cobblepot. She's his character's mother. He plays the nephew of the Penguin, and she plays his mother. So
would that be the Penguin's sister or sister-in-law?
I think it's his sister, but I'm not entirely sure. It's kind of a, you know, she's ambiguous. Just Mrs. Cobblepot, so.
And Jesse Flower plays young Franny at the science fair.
Yeah.
No Wikipedia page on that one, so we don't know.
Yeah.
Angela Bassett as Mildred.
Yeah, we're getting into, you know, really, really high, you know, Oscar nominated kind of work here. But, you know, she's in so many movies that you've seen. What's Love Got to Do With It, Boys in the Hood, Waiting to Exhale, all the way up to being Queen Ramonda in Black Panther and in Avengers Endgame. So when we get to Black Panther or the later Avengers movies, we will be talking about her again in that role, I'm sure.
All right. Adam West as Uncle Art.
Adam West.
Sorry. Nobody messes with Adam Wee.
Nobody messes with Adam Wee.
The legendary Adam West. Adam West could just not get away from playing superhero roles.
Yeah, this became the big kind of animation joke when he started doing voice acting. Like, you just had to, if there was like a, here's a person we want to do a superhero joke with, well, who are you going to call? Adam West.
Well, yeah, when we did the Kim Possible episode, we talked about him being the fearless ferret in that one.
But of course, he was the Gray Ghost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Classic.
I think that was probably where that kind of started, maybe, is that he came on to do the Gray Ghost on Batman the Animated Series, and they did it in a very dramatic, you know, that was not a comedy series.
Yeah,
And then everybody was like, oh, Adam West is doing voice acting now. Well, I know what we've got to do. Let's put a superhero joke in and put Adam West's voice in it.
Yeah, Uncle Art, the guy that dresses as a superhero and delivers pizza. Imagine you order pizza and there's Adam West to be your pizza delivery man.
And it was epic.
Yeah, it's great. I want my pizza delivered in a UFO by a superhero. And apparently, like, fired at you via cannon on the bottom of the saucer or whatever that is.
And apparently he does this, he it's not just Earth, he's an intergalactic pizza delivery person. Because he does say he went to other planets.
Does he go to Pizza Planet? Ah!
That's a crossover.
Okay,
we can do an entire episode on Adam West, but moving on, Laurie Metcalf as Lucille.
Yes.
Yeah.
The grandmother, invented the coffee patch.
Yeah, I want the coffee patch more than I want probably anything I've ever seen in a movie.
Patches 12 cups of coffee with no side effects. Ah!
Yeah. Yeah, most people know Laurie Metcalf from being Aunt Jackie on Roseanne. You know, Roseanne's sister on Roseanne. And then now continuing the Connors, on the Connors, which she is excellent on.
Laurie Metcalf is one of those actors that is, whatever the project is, if you add this actor to it, that project is now automatically X amount better because they're involved. It's like Laurie Metcalf can do no wrong. She is always epic.
She's also Sheldon Cooper's mother in The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was the original actress for Sheldon's mom. Yeah, and then, of course, she also is Andy's mom in the Toy Story franchise, so we will talk about her again
when we get around to Toy Story.
It's coming! We have a very full schedule, y'all.
Our entire summer is booked, guys. We have some really good stuff coming up.
Yeah.
Ethan Sandler as Doris, Uncle Fritz, Aunt Petunia, Spike Dimitri, Cousin Laszlo, and the CEO of Invenco. He is half the cast of this movie.
Yeah, and it seems that this is kind of his big role. He seems to be more a producer and a writer. He does do a lot of kind of guest acting. Most notably, he did 15 episodes of Crossing Jordan as a major recurring character, but other than that, he just kind of pops in and out for an episode here or there.
It makes me wonder if he was the voice actor for the Scratch animatics as they were working on the film, and they just decided, we'll just keep him.
It's very possible, but it does seem like a lot of his work is behind the scenes. So
it's possible. I mean, that's, in a way, that's kind of how Kyle got all the voices on Magiswords. We like this voice. Let's keep it.
And I wanted to mention, although not a Disney feature, the movie Storks, the female lead in that movie, she was hired to be the Scratch vocal person, and by the time they got ready to fully on make the movie, they were like, yeah, we all really want to keep her, and they gave her the job, so that was cool.
Okay, let's move on. Don Hall as Uncle Gaston and the gym coach.
Yeah, he does a lot of directing and writing, storyboarding. You know, it seems that this is another one where he was doing a lot of background work. Had worked with Disney for a while, and I'm assuming with Steve Anderson for a while, because he also worked on Tarzan and Emperor's New Groove, Brother Bear, Home on the Range, Chicken Little. I mean, he was kind of all over
Winnie
Disney.
Winnie the Pooh and Big Hero 6.
Yep.
He also worked on Moana.
Yeah, so, you know, a long career at Disney, but maybe not a household name. for his acting work. Much more an animator and behind the scenes.
Tom Kenny as Lewis's teacher, Mr. Willowstein. You know who Tom Kenny is. He's SpongeBob.
Yeah, we've talked about Tom Kenny before on this. Voice of SpongeBob. Voice of the Ice King in Adventure Time. You know, Tom Kenny's everywhere.
Yep.
He's also the voice of Rabbit on Winnie the Pooh. Hmm. You know, connecting once again to Steve Anderson.
Yep.
And most of the other characters are really, really small. Like, you have Kelly Hoover as Aunt Billy. There's really no page. We can't really talk about other stuff.
Yeah, the only kind of other big one is that the singing voice of the frog, Freddie the Frog.
Frankie the Frog.
Frankie Frog, excuse me. Yeah. Thank you. Is Jamie Cullum, who is an English pop song and TV presenter, and if you watch a lot of British television, as I do, you see him pop up kind of everywhere, but he is a very kind of, one of those Michael Bublé kind of throwback voices.
It works in this one with the swing style of the
yeah, play. No, I mean, and he's very well known for doing that style of music. But much more well known in England than he is over here. So yeah, if you watch a lot of British TV, you'll know him. If you just primarily deal with American stuff, he's probably not a name you know, but he pops up on a lot of panel shows and things I watch all the time. So it was interesting to go like, wait, that voice sounds very familiar, and realize that that's who that was.
All right.
I do want to say one thing real quick, speaking of music, is that the music for this was done by Danny Elfman.
Hey!
Huzzah for Danny Elfman!
We've talked about Danny Elfman a lot on this show, especially with his work with Tim Burton.
Yeah, we do talk. We have talked about Danny Elfman before. But yeah, I mean, you know, started out as kind of the weird experimental new wave 80s guy, and then became like one of the greatest film score people, film composers in history. So yeah,
it definitely doesn't sound like Oingo Boingo in this movie.
Yeah, I was actually kind of shocked when I saw that it was him doing the music, because it's not his typical style. I'll give him a lot of credit for stretching on this one. This was a very typical, I won't say typical Disney style, because that makes you think of like the Broadway kind of Ashman Mankin kind of style, but this is very much a like kids movie style.
Yeah.
So I really give him credit for branching out like that for this one.
I think that's all we can talk about the voice actors and everyone involved with this movie. Do you want
to? Yeah, let's get into the plot just real quick.
Yeah, so we got Lewis here, 12-year-old. He grows up in an orphanage. He never really knows who his mother is, and he tries to get adopted, but he also has this desire for being an inventor. And none of the parents that he interviews with never really connects. And to the point where he just almost is giving up on getting adopted, because he is 12 years old, and he even says how hard it is for a teenager to get adopted. And he kind of gives up until he figures out, wait, I can find my birth mother. I know what she looks like. All I have to do is find it in my head. What she looks like, and I can find her, invents this memory scanner and puts it into the science fair, and, you know, see where that goes. And here comes the bowler hat guy to kind of steal it away, and there's Wilbur trying to keep young Lewis on his path of science, and, you know, at that time, he doesn't know why. But the plot of Lewis's story is very interesting in that he's this kid that he never had a family. He doesn't know what his family is. And he's just, for lack of a better term, just a little weird to get adopted. It's kind of, you know, he's kind of I wouldn't say an outcast, but he's just a little too strange for some of the parents, especially the one pair of parents that we do see him interviewed with, the Harringtons.
Yeah, who he almost kills.
Yes. The invention we see him beginning at the beginning of the movie is a peanut butter and jelly sandwich making machine. And the Mr. Harrington is allergic to peanuts. The peanut butter splashes on him, and he has this really, really big allergic reaction.
Yeah.
Kudos to the EpiPen as the wife just stabs him with it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, even though she just stabs him with a typical syringe instead of an actual EpiPen, like, here's a tip. If you ever have to use an EpiPen on someone, and I pray you never do, you really do have to, like, stab them hard with those things if you want the medicine to inject. So,
well, I think they should use a regular syringe because EpiPen, I think, is copyrighted.
Well, yeah, that too. But yeah, it kind of an interesting nod to peanut allergies in this film. I had forgotten that was in there, so
yeah.
But I do like the idea that he wants it to be able to work on toasted or untoasted bread.
Yeah.
I do like the idea of, as you can see, toast is an option.
And you know, with the Harringtons, especially with the Harringtons, they're more interested in a kid that can play sports versus a academic student, which...
Yeah, why are they not interviewing Goob?
Yeah.
Like, why would the woman in charge of the orphanage not be like, hey, we've got this, like, really good ball player?
There is a scene later in the movie with Goob interviewing with the Harringtons. It's a blink and you miss it one, but he's so obsessed with the baseball game that he kind of shuns him away.
But why didn't they start with that? This seems like a very obvious overlook on the part, but I don't know.
And it's like, yeah, I mean, excuse me. But yeah, I mean, that's a big part of this, of the beginning of the movie, is him stealing all these parts, not only from around the orphanage, but from his school, because he does go to a school.
Yeah.
Just to make this thing, him stealing the basketball rim and apparently not getting in trouble for it because they let him keep it.
But also he seems to be buying a lot of parts from the
junk shop.
Like,
yeah.
Junk shop. And I'm like, where is this kid getting an allowance?
Maybe he's getting it from the head of the orphanage.
Maybe he's selling peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to kids at his school.
Maybe.
Before the peanut butter ban went into effect. In K-12 schools.
And one thing with Goob, I like the detail of giving him bags under his eyes.
Yeah, that is some good animation. I like the character design of young Goob.
Like, this is not the first time Lewis has kept Goob up all night.
Yeah.
This seems to be a child suffering from, like, 12 years of sleep deprivation.
And he even says it's you know, it's what he gets for having a science geek for a roommate. So he kind of accepts it. But you would think that at some point they would have either moved him to a different room or something if this was a big problem.
It's also kind of weird that because, you know, young Goob doesn't seem to be an unintelligent person. But it's like the passage of time over all the years seems to have made him significantly dumber by the time he becomes Bowler Hat Guy.
Well, he kind of stops going to school after 12 years old, so.
Yeah.
Well, and also, like I said, 12 years of sleep deprivation at this point. Yeah, I'm just going to say.
Yeah, he's probably insane at this point.
I am just going to say that, I have, like, a weird sleep disorder, and because of that, and because kind of children are forced into the, like, well, of course you must wake up at 6 a.m. to be on the bus by 7 to be at school by 8 kind of thing, I was sleep deprived for the first 18 years of my life. Not even joking. I would get, like, 2 or 3 hours of sleep a night and then crash during the weekends. And they're about there was a point in time where I kind of started to wonder, you know, my grades were slipping and stuff. And there were other things that happened at the same time and other kind of traumas. But there was one point where I started to wonder, like, am I dumb? Like, what's wrong with me that I can't just, like, sleep at night and go to school and my brain is always fuzzy and my, you know. And it wasn't until I got into college and they were like, do you want to take morning classes or afternoon classes? And I was like, that's a thing? You can take classes afternoon and, like, nobody will make you get up at 8 a.m.? And when I started taking afternoon classes, my grades went back up and I was on the dean's list and I was on the, because that's when I'm awake. And now I have a rule that I do not teach classes before noon. I will only take afternoon or online classes, and my boss is very aware that I am not a morning person and you will not hear from me in the morning. And I'm excelling now that I'm on my normal schedule because now I can sleep. So I know firsthand exactly what Goob is going through in these, like, when you don't sleep and you're still expected to perform at the same level of everybody else, it really does make you feel somehow less than.
Yeah, that Chris Rock once did a stand-up piece where he mentioned that he had to get up at 6 a.m. to take a bus for 2 hours to compete with kids who didn't have to be up until 8 a.m. And he did the joke. It's like, oh, Chris can't read. No, Chris is tired.
Yeah, exactly.
Give Chris a nap, then I'll take you back.
Yeah, and I, you know, I can vouch for that from my own experience. That is absolutely what I went through for most of my K-12 education. And so,
what you're saying is that Lewis is the real villain of this story, is what you're saying.
Yes, that is. I'm not even joking. That is kind of what I'm saying. In the original timeline, I absolutely felt awful for Bowler Hat Guy. And the movie does seem to kind of have this, I'm going to use a term I heard recently, which is radical responsibility, like radical individual responsibility of, like, well, yeah, you had a sucky life, but you should have just forgotten about it and moved on. And that's not really possible for most people. Like, if you're able to do that, I am in wonder of you, but most of us have baggage. And I really felt for Goob. Like, I'm not saying he should have turned it into, I will destroy everything that
Lewis has ever done.
Lewis has ever done, yeah. But at the same time, like, you can absolutely grow up thinking that that guy was a selfish jerk who ruined things for you that were very important and never even said, I'm sorry, never even noticed what he did, apparently, in the original storyline.
Yep, as you find out that because Lewis kept Goob up all night because working on the not only the peanut butter cannon, but the brain scanner.
Yeah.
He ends up falling asleep in the middle of the baseball game and misses the catch, costing their team the game.
But even more than that, he got beat up, but, like, violently assaulted by his entire team, which at that point, please ruin the Little League coach's life too, because why didn't an adult step in and that?
Yeah, if you pay attention, it kind of builds up as that Goob is saying now that their team has been undefeated the entire season. If you pay attention to what he's saying now, they've been undefeated the entire season, and the team that they're fighting is like the lowest ranked team in the league. They've never won they've never won a game, so it's a cakewalk as long as he can stay awake, and he doesn't, and they lose.
Yeah, and then remember the violent assault, because I really feel like the movie glosses over that in a way it shouldn't. Like, well, of course your team was right to just beat the crap out of you afterwards.
And Goob kind of takes it like it is his fault. He even says it. It's my fault. It's, you know, he somehow justifies them beating him up as he has, you know, the stake over his bruised eye. Like, you know, like,
Steak, you're my only friend.
Yeah, poor Goob.
I feel that, because there have been nights when I have looked at a steak on my plate and been like, you are my only friend, steak. I will now eat you.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, and Lewis has no he has no idea what he's done to Goob. At least, you know, the original timeline.
Yeah.
And he even says, I never knew. I didn't know. Lewis is so into his own inventions that he's barely paying attention to Goob.
Yeah, and that means in the original timeline, because we see the kind of, you know, as Bowler Hat Guy is explaining who he is in the big reveal, you see this, you know, this kind of timeline of how he kind of stopped bathing and stopped going to school and just stopped everything, was lashing out in anger at everyone.
And even, it's even like, people who were trying to be his friend.
Yeah, and if that was your roommate and you didn't notice that, like, man, how self-involved are you to not notice that?
I mean, we talked about this earlier. Goob is talking to him about how much the baseball game means to him, and Lewis is just ignoring him, using him kind of as a prop to hold up the parts for the peanut butter and jelly cannon.
Yeah, and like a mannequin later to test the brain scan on, and things like that. So,
and keep in mind that Lewis gets adopted right after the science fair. So yeah. That is the last time he sees Goob.
Well, yeah, I guess he wasn't there for the complete meltdown, so maybe we'll give him a pass on that one, but still.
But still, he was kind of a jerk to this guy that's supposed to be his roommate. I wouldn't say friend, but it's definitely his roommate.
Yeah.
And, you know,
So yeah, Wilbur at the science fair finds Lewis and says, you know, hey, I gotta come save you. He claims to be a time cop at first, but that falls apart very quickly.
His badge is a coupon for a tanning salon.
I do like the trying to pass the badge to the coupon off as a badge.
Addams Family, I do have to mention of the little girl that is very much Wednesday Addams.
I love that girl. She is my favorite. The little fire ant girl where they're like, Lizzie, you know, fire ants bite people. Only my enemies. Mm-hmm. Like, because that little girl was me. Like,
there was no way this little girl wasn't inspired by Wednesday Addams.
Oh, of course not. But like, I felt a great kinship with that little girl. That and the young mom with her frogs.
Young Franny, yeah.
Yeah, young Franny, like, don't mess with me, I know karate. Like,
him talking to what would be his future son.
Yeah.
And he is freaking out. I don't know if he realized that was his future mom, but he's definitely reacting in fear to this woman, this young girl.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, she was always this way.
There was something I was going to say earlier, and then I didn't because I didn't want to interrupt you guys, but just to kind of say this before we get too far away from it, talking about, you know, the original timeline versus the alternate timeline. So Lewis goes back and, you know, tells Goob to wake up so he catches the ball, and then, you know, he becomes like the hero of the ball game because apparently they win. In my mind, I'd like to like think that in the future of that timeline, after that change had been made, that that bowler head guy grew up to become a baseball star. Like, I like, in my mind, I could picture some fan art of him like being the pitcher on some, you know, baseball thing with like, with still with the huge awesome mustache, and like, but perhaps his body design is a bit more fit version, so that the roundness is much more up in the chest, so he's like, you know, throwing pitches and winning games, and like, it's like, you know, your champion, Mike Yagoobian, and the whole stadium people, Goob, 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 Goob. Yeah. Like, people holding up signs that say Goob, like, that's his big nickname, and everyone loves Goob. It's like, I would have loved to have seen, like, I don't know, this was before the age of post-credit scenes, but that would have been a nice little post-credit scene if that had been a thing.
That would have been a nice scene, you know, you see Lewis and Franny kind of get together on their first date, and then you see Goob become a baseball star, and then a scene of them getting married, and there's, you know, the birth of Wilbur. And maybe Goob's there, too, because Goob is now the godfather.
Yeah, brings him a baseball or something, you know.
Yeah.
Luke, I think your next art project has to be the Goob baseball card. I want to see the Goob baseball card. But I hope...
They come included with bubble gum that's made by the Robinson Corporation.
Yeah, it's... So are you saying that the Robinson Corporation is also the Wonka Corporation? It's just Mike TV now runs...
They dabble in a little bit of everything. It's not, you know...
Yeah, I mean, if they dabble in peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah. I just love Goob taking the coffee from Mildred and just dunking it down. Oh, that's good, Joe.
Yeah. That is such a good scene where he just, like, looks at her and it just gives her the juice box and takes the mug.
Billboards of him advertising meat products, Mr. Steak.
Yes, your only friend.
Your tummy's only friend, Mr. Steak.
Yeah, I honestly would have loved... I know that there was a plan...
There was plans for a sequel, but
yeah.
Lasseter kind of shut it down because he shut down all of the sequels at the time.
Yeah, I would have liked if this had gotten a sequel to kind of see more about what happened to Goob, because we do get the feeling that he did get adopted and that he probably stayed in baseball. You know,
we see him with the MVP trophy right after the game, right after he gets adopted.
In front of a couple of parents who we think are probably going to adopt him. You know, I mean, it's there that he obviously had a better life in the changed timeline.
And this is, you know, Lewis realizes how... It's Lewis himself realizing how much of a jerk he's been to Goob all these years.
Yeah, I honestly think that one scene of him going back to the baseball game is the biggest point of character growth in the entire movie.
Like, he's right there going back to the science fair, and he just stops, like, wait, I have to fix something.
Yeah.
And he just goes back and, you know, yells, Goob, wake up!
I know most people would say that it's the mother, but... The plot point with the mother is still a selfish plot point.
Yeah.
He is choosing a future that he likes over one he doesn't know. Mm-hmm. I can guarantee this future will be really awesome for me. I don't know what my future would be like if I had my birth mother in my life.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go for the future where I'm like a really rich inventor and have a hot wife and stuff.
Well, the way they say it is that, like, he never had a family, and then he knows he will have a family.
Yeah.
He will have that family he's always wanted, that dream family, so he doesn't really need to see the mother.
Yeah. But I will say that it still comes across as a sort of selfish choice. Mm-hmm. In that moment, but what he does for Goob comes across as like the first selfless thing he's really done in the movie.
Yeah.
Which I love. I find that to be possibly my favorite moment, you know, as far as a story element.
I mean, can you take from Goob, you know, he's there, he's the only one left in the orphanage, again, because he becomes obsessed with losing that baseball game, and hearing that radio over this person that in his mind ruined his life is getting all the success. You know, Lewis graduates college at 14. He wins the Nobel Peace Prize. He gets the News Corporation. All these good things happen to him, and now Goob has nothing.
Yeah, and I honestly, again, I just felt so much like that because it's like, you know, my entire life, it's just like, you know, I don't know, people you go to school with or whatever, and you grow up and you're like, they ended up with their own business and their own, you know, like they ended up with a really good life. And then like the nicest person you know from school is always like, you know, just barely making it, doesn't have any friends. Like, it just, I see it over and over again where it's like, that jerk got everything and the nice people, you know. So I feel for Goob. I'm not saying that he went the right way with it, but the base emotions, I just, the entire movie, I'm like, oh, Goob, I just want to give you a hug.
Yeah, they do say that, you know, he kind of gets obsessed over that one moment in his life, and I understand what they're trying to do. Hey, you know, you can't just obsess over this one thing, you have to move on. And yeah, the way it's described is kind of bad, like you said earlier, but he kind of never got past that one moment, that one part of his life. He never decides that I'm going to not let this define me and become my own person rather than let Lewis control my life.
Yeah. Let's talk about when they get to the future and the family, because it is called Meet the Robinsons.
And yes, this is, and like I said, but this is pretty much the book.
Before we get to that, I just kind of want to make sure I'm you know, accurately getting the summary of the stuff you've been saying in this most recent chunk, is that our main character Lewis is a completely self-involved, you know, all absorbed with what he's doing to the detriment of everyone around him, and he basically doesn't care about anything else or anybody else, and he makes all of his decisions, you know, basically it's because, you know, it's what's best for him, it's what he likes, etc. So he's basically, you know, kind of a jerk and the real villain of the story, and also that Lewis Robinson is me. So that's basically what the whole summary of your take on this whole thing is. So
I don't know where you're putting those two together. I didn't say nothing. That's Tuesday you want.
You literally said at the beginning of this episode that I'm Lewis. And then you spent
No, Tuesday said that. I didn't say anything. No,
Credit up, I'm a co-host.
No. The thing is though, is that I don't think Lewis is an unsympathetic character, because I think everybody has that thing that they got obsessed with as a kid. You know, for Goob, it was baseball. Goob is very focused in on his baseball thing. And Goob also doesn't, I mean, he does help Lewis more than Lewis helps him, but he's not interested necessarily in what Lewis is doing.
His dumb projects.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not saying it's necessarily, you know, all on Lewis, but I think that kids can relate, and I know I can, to having something that you're like really focused on as a kid. Like, this is the most important thing in the world. And it might be a video game, or maybe you got really into Lego as a kid, or insects, or, you know, all kinds of things that kids have. And goodness knows I was that kid for a lot of my childhood. Like, if you were near me when I was a kid, it's gonna be like, no, sit down and listen to this awesome thing that I'm doing. And everybody I was near was like, we don't care. This is completely uninteresting.
He's at it again.
Yeah. So I think that Lewis is also a very relatable child character. He acts like a kid.
Mm-hmm. And which kids is rare for these kind of movies.
We've talked about it before.
Most of these movies where you see a kid, it's a kid being written by an adult, a kid talking like an adult, not a kid talking like a kid.
But the interesting thing is Lewis does talk like an adult, but he also acts like a kid. And I think the last time we really talked about this was Lilo.
Yeah.
That Lilo does very much act like a kid and is very self-involved like a kid is. And also has to learn to kind of work together with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that, and I, you know how much I loved Lilo and Stitch.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there is a lot for kids to see in Lewis, and I wouldn't call him the villain. I'm not sure this movie really has a villain other than Doris.
Yeah.
It's kind of easy to call Doris the villain, because it's like, well, it's a machine and it wants to take over humanity. That's a very easy two-dimensional villain. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, has a beef against Lewis. Like, you know, you invented me and then you wanted me to be a thing that you weren't, which is fair, but also goes the wrong way with it in turning everybody into bowler hat zombies.
Very much Terminator.
I would love to do a
Terminator.
Yeah.
Terminator.
I would love to do a group cosplay whenever conventions are a thing again, where there's just a bunch of us as bowler hat zombies.
Bowler hat zombies is my favorite ska band. I love those guys.
Yeah, I think I saw them open for Scooter Picnic once.
Damn it, that was my good joke.
And the Aquabats.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that if you're going to say this movie has just a traditional villain, then Doris is kind of the only thing you're left with. Because
it starts that idea of, you know, so a lot of people have said of the more recent Disney movies that there really isn't a real villain. You can kind of say it kind of starts here.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Frozen, on paper, you would say Elsa would be the villain, but she kind of really isn't. It really doesn't have a villain until, like, the final act.
And I love movies like that. I love a movie where it's complicated enough that you can be like, well, I disagree with this action, but I also understand this character. Mm-hmm. I've never really liked the, like, you
evil,
know...
but it's like evil?
Yeah. Hi, I'm here, I'm gonna destroy the world. Why? Because it's evil and I want to be evil. I mean, it's kind of, it's... Sometimes those can be fun, but they don't really make for compelling drama.
Yeah, a character can still be evil, but you can kind of understand where the evil comes from.
Yeah, because the second you find out the history between Lewis and Goob and how Goob turns into bowler hat guy, then you're like, oh my god, this is a really deep story at this point.
And something that could happen in real life.
And something that could happen in real life, minus the crazy robot bowler hats. But this is 2020, and we might have crazy robot bowler hats by the end of it.
We already have murder hornets and everything else that's going on right now. Crazy robot bowler hats is next on the bingo card.
Yeah. Place your bets now, folks. But I love that complexity. I love that there's no, like, you can't just say Goob was always a bad guy. He was always destined for evil. Like, no, something happened to him and he took it maybe the wrong way, but it is understandable. And Lewis isn't a complete one-note jerk either. I think it's completely inaccurate to read him that way. He's a kid.
And like I said, any kid, he would get obsessed over one thing. For him, it is inventing. It's science. And that the blinders are there and it's straight ahead science, science, science at the expense of his roommate, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got... you know, as an adult just a few years ago, diagnosed with ADHD, and there's part of it called hyperfocus, and that's, you know, absolutely what I see Lewis doing, is he's so intent on doing the specific thing. He's very fixated on that the rest of the world just falls away and he's not paying attention at all.
Yeah.
That happens to me all the time.
you know, like I said, I've been there, 'cause same, but I think if you're going to put, and I really hate to say blame, but I think that both of these kids were really let down by every adult around them.
Mildred tries, but she's not a mother. She is just the person that's running the orphanage. And she tries her best to try to get these kids into homes that fit them. And as we talked about before, here's a family that wants an athlete and you're putting them with an academic.
Yeah. But also, you get the feeling that Mildred doesn't really teach them anything. Like, she kind of shows up, she gives them food, she makes sure that they bathe and stuff, which is great. I'm not calling her a bad guy either. But kids need a little bit more than that. Like, she knows that there's tension between Lewis and Goob. She knows that the things Lewis are doing is keeping Goob awake and making him, like, upset and annoyed. And instead of going, like, okay, Lewis, we've got to have, like, you know, at 10 p.m. you have to be in bed, like, you know, sorry. You know, you've got to think about the other person, too.
Or if you're going to work in your experiments, work out in another part of the house.
Yeah.
Another part of the building.
Yeah, go down to the dining room and work there so Goob can sleep or something. I mean, there are ways to get around this. And, of course, I think the unseen Little League coach is probably the real villain of the movie. Like, yeah. How do you let a kid get beat up like that and not do something about it? Like, oh my God.
Is it the same coach that we see in the science fair?
No, I don't believe it is. I think he's just the, you know, the PE coach. Teacher at the school, you know. I do love that the Little League team is called the Dinos.
Would this be a reference to the Good Dinosaur that would come out sometime later?
Yeah.
It's one of those Disney things that they put the hint of the next movie in there.
No, but an actual Disney reference in there is, if you look at behind Goob, the back wall of the ball field, there are very faded posters for the Jungle Book.
Mm.
Awesome. I also love the continuing that the wall across the street from the orphanage has like brain scanners from Mars or something on it, which I think is a great like nod to his brain scan invention.
Well, he sees the post. Yeah, a brain scanner. I'll make one of those.
I love that that's there and that it continues to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
We've talked about this a lot. If you want to, like you were saying earlier before we got off track, let's actually talk about the actual Robinson family.
This is very much a kind of, if the Addams Family were really sciencey.
Yeah.
Like, it's very much that kind of offbeat family.
I mean, you get Grandpa Bud, who is obsessed with wearing his clothes backwards, to the point where he has a face written on the back of his head.
Yeah, and then the grandma, who, of course, we later find out is a scientist as well. And she also mentions, like, the first time she won an Olympic gold medal and all these other kind of things that she's done in her life. So she seems to be an incredibly accomplished woman. And also the two of them seem to be rich that they could just buy an entire observatory at the end of the movie and turn it into their house.
And then we meet, you know, the other members of the family, the brother who is just sitting on a couch and, oh, he works out.
Yeah, some of the family I don't feel is as fleshed out as I would like them to be.
Well, there are members of the family that don't talk. I said the one brother on the couch doesn't say a word.
Yeah, you know how much I love my fat jokes in movies, and that one kind of hit in that same way for me. I like the one guy who's apparently married to a puppet.
And they have two kids.
Yeah,
how does that work?
I hesitate to guess. I hope that there's like some kind of cloning invention that Cornelius invents in the future.
Lots of splinters in places that splinters shouldn't go.
Yeah.
Well, this is a film with you know, where adoption is very much a part of the themes of the film. So
maybe.
Yeah. Let's hope. And then, you know, we've got the two people with, like, weird stuff on their heads. Like, the dude with the rocket on his head, and then, like, the one girl that just has, like, a cityscape on her head.
The two cousins, ring my doorbell. No, ring my doorbell. And I love the fact that no one knows who they're related to.
Yeah. Which is a joke that also, again, gets used occasionally in Addams Family.
Like, they are just these two twin guys that just, like, showed up one day. And
They just moved into the shrubbery outside our door, and we let them live there.
All right, you're Robinsons now. Welcome to the family. Who are they related to? Like, oh, your cousins. I thought my cousins. I thought they were your cousins.
I love Lefty the octopus.
Yeah, the butler.
Yeah. Hey,
who wouldn't want a giant squid to be their butler?
You get the feeling that they do adopt that dinosaur. Like, eventually they've just got a T-Rex pet.
I'm glad that that dinosaur didn't have anything important to do with the, you know, evolution of the planet or anything.
Yeah. It turns out that this dinosaur was father to an entire line of, you know...
Now we don't have pigeons anymore. This dinosaur's in the modern day, pigeons don't exist.
Yeah. I think I'd be okay with that. That dinosaur joke, though...
That was the hook of their advertising campaign.
Yeah, that was their entire commercial campaign. It was like, meet the Robinsons, it has a dinosaur.
It's like,
but you have tiny arms! Like, that was the entire commercial.
I remember there were commercials around the movie coming out of, you know, please turn off your cell phones, and they edited the scene of the frog throwing the hat into the trunk with a bunch of cell phones in it.
I remember that one. That's cool.
Yeah, so they had the frog kind of snap the fingers and shut the trunk and has everybody's cell phone, and don't use your cell phone during the movie.
I think that one of the reasons that this movie is not better remembered, and we've talked about this before with other movies, is that the advertising didn't know what to do with this movie.
It really didn't. I mean, this, like I said, the focus was on the dinosaur.
Is about a minute and a half of the movie.
It is one of my favorite jokes in the movie, though, is the one with the dog. Oh, why does your dog have glasses? Oh, because his insurance won't pay for contacts.
That is a good joke.
And I love that there's a rim shot. There's an audible rim shot on there. It's like, yes, thank you. I love those type of jokes.
And I love that the mom was obsessed with frogs as a little girl and then just kept that obsession.
Genetically enhanced frogs. She experimented on frogs to become her swing jazz band.
But also gave them, like, their own bar, their own, like, tiny little froggy cars. They developed a frog mafia. Like, I want an entire Minions-type franchise
about the
frogs from Meet the Robinsons.
With their little suits.
And then they bring in the dinosaur as the enforcer. Like, we're going to have to call Tiny in.
So talking about the how, you know, the advertising didn't know how to advertise this movie. Something else that came into existence in the year 2007 was the sitcom The Big Bang Theory. And, you know, I'm not going to debate, you know, whether or not, you know, The Big Bang Theory is good or bad. Yeah. Personally, I like it. But my main point is this. America and sort of the world was just on the cusp of the people of power in Hollywood figuring out that, you know, fandom culture, nerdy culture, geeky culture was a thing. I mean, Iron Man came out when? 2008? 2009? Yeah. So, I mean, so it was, you know, once the Marvel movies became huge, then it became like, oh, wait, we can make money off of nerds because they're everywhere and they have lots of money. It's like, so basically, the fact that, you know, somebody would, you know, because of the power that the people who made Two and a Half Men made The Big Bang Theory. So they had the kind of clout to say, we want to do our nerd show, and it happened. And then suddenly it's like, oh, so all of this stuff that we've been saying is for these nerd people who are on the fringes. It's like, it turns out these supposed fringe people are the majority of the people now. And so my point is that if Meet the Robinsons had come out, I don't know, 5 years later, they probably would have had a better time figuring out how to advertise it, because they would have had a better understanding at that point that, yeah, there's all these people who are into science and love time travel and love this type of comedy, and they might have been able to advertise it better to kids and adults other than saying, look at the dinosaur. I mean, again, one of the best jokes in the film. Super awesome. Love it. You know, a huge comedy fan. That is excellently executed comedy. Also a running gag, which I love. But that was the focus of all of the quick commercials I saw, was just Meet the Robinsons. Why aren't you seizing the boy? I've got a big head, a little arms. Meet the Robinsons. See it in theaters now. Like, that was so many of the quick advertisements. So,
but you know, this movie is about, like you said, it resonated with you and with Steph because it's about finding a family where you're not sure you have one.
Gee, what kind of people part find of the family where they didn't have one? Oh, nerds!
But also, that's like a typical Disney storyline in a way. You know, not necessarily in this way, but finding family and finding home and finding love.
Yeah, the original Disney movie was Snow White escaping her abusive mother and finding a new family with the Seven Dwarves.
Yeah, and I, you know, and Cinderella, kind of same, you know. But why not play up that angle? You know, it's even the poster, you know, I'm kind of looking at the poster that they did for it. It's just like, oh, you think your family's different? Wait till you meet the family of the future. And it's like, but it doesn't really tell us why we're meeting this family. And I'm not saying that they should necessarily give away the plot, but there has to be ways of, like, you know, maybe I can come live in the future with you and be part of your family. Like, play up that boy looking for an adopted family. You don't have to talk about how he's connected to them. Because there's a whole chunk of the movie about, man, I wish this was my family that they could have pulled from before Lewis ever knows the truth that this is his family.
Yeah.
And I hate when I see movies that have such potential that are just absolutely screwed by bad advertising choices.
Yeah.
Where they either give away the twist of the movie, or they do it as a, you know, completely different.
The movie that exists is not the movie they're selling you.
Yeah. And honestly, we talked about that with Lilo and Stitch as well.
Yeah.
That Lilo and Stitch did not, they didn't really know how to advertise that one either. And the ad campaign was more interesting, but it also didn't make me want to go see the movie in theaters.
Yeah, the movie, I mean, we talked about the Aphrodisiacal Stitch, was just Stitch parodying or invading all these other Disney movies.
Yeah, but it didn't actually tell us anything about Lilo and Stitch as a movie. And I feel that Meet the Robinsons got that. And most of the movies, honestly, in this Disney, kind of this experimental Disney era.
And I wanted to comment on the Lilo and Stitch advertising that I, you know, the lack of Lilo in the Lilo and Stitch advertising. It's like, basically, whether they intended to do this or not, it led to, we didn't know anything about Lilo going to Lilo and Stitch, and then we were all really pleasantly surprised by how awesome and hilarious Lilo was. It's like none of those jokes got spoiled in the trailers when, you know, Lilo laying there on the floor listening to Elvis and lip syncing after having nailed the door shut. It's like Lilo is the best.
Yeah, and the thing is I love Lilo. You know, I mean, that was my first watch of Lilo and Stitch, was doing it for this show. I had missed it until like a couple of months ago. But Lilo is now one of my favorite Disney characters of all time, and I'm kind of annoyed that she wasn't featured in any freaking commercials, because I probably would have gone seen the movie in theaters and had all these years of loving this movie, rather than like suddenly this is a movie that I've seen and I love now. Yeah. So, I, you know, the advertising department can make or break a movie, and I'm sad when they break movies that really deserved better. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of them, is that they just did not know or care how to advertise this, and it makes me very, very sad.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's kind of go a little forward at this point. Let's talk a little bit about Goob meeting Goob. Past Goob meeting future Goob. Where future Goob, you know, bowler hat guy, telling his younger self, yeah, let that anger fester inside you. Let it, you know, let the anger control you.
Thank you, Emperor Palpatine.
Give me.
I don't know. I know there's different types of names for different types of paradoxes, but it's like there's a moment where young Goob is, you know, saying like, well, maybe I should just, you know, not let this thing bother me. And then future Goob is like, no, he does this great speech about, you know, just like, you know, you've got to hold it inside you. Let it motivate you. It's like, so basically his future bitter self inspires his young, not bitter self to become the future bitter self.
Yeah.
Which makes you wonder, like, in the original timeline, did he also do this?
Yeah.
Because it seems to be the impetus in the timeline we see unfolding that later kind of gets aborted, but, like, well, what happened originally to make him fester like that?
Well, we don't, I mean, Bowler Hat Guy seems shocked that he's actually interacting with his younger self, as if he doesn't remember this happening 30 years prior.
Maybe he was just too sleep deprived to remember.
Probably.
But it is a good scene, and it is, like I said, it's a very Star Warsy scene.
And Stephanie had said to me that, or actually I think she even was posting about it back on LiveJournal, because that was the form of the day.
We're old!
Yeah.
So just that whole notion, or that whole scene where Bowler Hat Guy is spelling out for Goob, like, all of the instructions he has to do to, which is basically this huge list of, like, these are behaviors you shouldn't engage in if you're going to be a, you know, healthy person. But it's expressed in such a way that points out, you know, the illogic and the ridiculousness of it, and how it's, you know, it's a cautionary example. It's like, this stuff is bad. And that her seeing that laid out, even though it was laid out for humor, it was still laid out really well. And it helped her realize about herself that she needed to, you know, do things for herself and not let the fact that other people or other things in the past have, you know, messed up her life or taken it off course. She can't just sit around and be angry about that. She has to, you know, keep moving forward. She has to, you know, do the thing she needs to do. And I don't want to get all off on a thing about her, so I won't, but she has, you know, over the past 10 or more years, like, really made a lot of improvements in her life, and I'm super proud of her. And I know that she cites this movie as being one of the main examples that helped her realize she needed to make changes in her life. So,
yeah.
We've talked before on this show. We talked about it a lot when we were talking about Waking Sleeping Beauty, about Walt Disney's forward thinking. And that one of the things that kind of led to the kind of end of the Disney Renaissance, in our opinion, was that people stopped looking forward. They kept looking back to what Walt would have done.
Yeah, after Walt died, it was what Walt wanted.
Yeah, and the thing we kind of came to was Walt would have wanted you to keep looking for the next new thing.
You know, very much into new technology. We talked about before, like, that's why Walt went more towards live action movies in the later half of his life versus the animated, because finally live action had caught up to what he could do in his mind with animation.
Yeah, and constantly looking for, you know, the next animatronic, you know, thing, or the next ride or attraction that you could put in the park, or, you know, well, TV is out now. Let's see what we can do with TV.
Yeah, it's like that Walt never viewed any new technology or new abilities to perform or express, you know, oneself as, you know, as the enemy. He was like, oh, how can I use this to tell a story? How can we as a company use these new things to tell new stories? You know,
we talked about this in the Wake of City of Beauty episode, but can you imagine if Walt had quit smoking at an earlier point in his life and had made it to the point where Disney was using computers?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we would have seen the weird breakup that eventually formed Pixar. I think that would have just been the next step of Disney.
Yeah. DreamWorks would not exist.
DreamWorks probably would not exist, yeah. You can make up your own decision about whether that's good or bad. I would have actually been sad had that never come about. But, you know, it would have been a very different thing, except that some people at the Disney company, I think, got paralyzed and kept looking backward. And I kind of give, I don't know if this was Anderson's point or not, being caught in the thick of it at the time, but I kind of liked the idea of, like, no, we got to keep going forward. This is, you know, it's a computer animated film. It's beautiful, by the way. Mm-hmm. I watched this thing on a 4K TV. You know, the colors are amazing.
Yeah, for
the textures.
For a 15-plus-year-old movie that actually still looks really good.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, you know, we'll get to it, but go back and look at that first Toy Story movie. That animation does not hold up as well as you remember. This animation does. It's friggin' beautiful.
See, it's like not just at Disney, but at many studios, there was this, you know, pretty much starting with Toy Story, and we'd have to, that's something I'd have to think about for an extended period of time. I'll bring this up to Kyle on as a topic or as a question, at least for our podcast, is at what point did CG animation get to the point where they could make humans that look like humans that don't look weird and creepy? Because, you know, even if you look at something like the Shrek films, I mean, they did pretty darn awesomely, but they're still like Shrek and Donkey and all the other non-human characters, you know, definitely have a lot more life to them than, you know, Fiona and Prince Charming and other stuff, you know. But it's like, oh, here's human characters, but we're going to make them look cartoony, and they look great. It's, you know, you don't have to make a human being look like a physical, you know, replication of reality human being in your animated film in order for it to work.
See, now I'm thinking of that CGI Final Fantasy movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I don't know, but I like, I've got some personal issues maybe with parts of how the moral of the story is handled in kind of microcosm in some scenes. Mm-hmm. But I do like the overall thing in kind of the macro sense of humanity keeps needing to look forward. And that was what Cornelius, I think, gave as he started to become an adult and start his corporation and eventually led to the world we see. Mm-hmm. Is that
right now we've kind of become stagnant in our technology. It's just improving on what exists and not really inventing anything new.
Yeah, it's an iPhone, but it's like iPhone 12 instead of iPhone 11. It's almost exactly the same.
We gave it a new camera, you know?
Yeah. Let's just real quick talk about Doris, because I did kind of like that character. Like the original idea that Doris was a
helper hat. Yeah.
Like, you put on a hat, it'll brush your teeth for you, it'll fix your makeup, it'll do whatever.
It'll fix your tie, it'll, you know.
Yeah.
and it gained sentience and wanted to think it thought itself superior. It like I said, it's Terminator, pretty much.
I'm not even sure it gained sentience. I have a feeling that Cornelius would be like, well, of course you'd give it sentience, you know, because all the other technology he seems to have invented also has sentience, like Carl.
Yeah.
Is that Carl has sentience, but also Carl seems content.
Well, he does give Lewis a little bit of an upgrade idea for him.
Well, I mean, yes, everybody wants to upgrade themselves in tiny little ways, but he seems content with his existence in general.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I feel good about the work I do. I feel good about the family I'm with.
Don't forget to invent me.
Yeah, don't forget to invent me. I like my existence the way it is. Whereas Doris was not, you know, Doris knew that it could be more.
Yeah. Just, you know, more than just helping humans. It could take over humanity. It could rule humanity.
But again, we're kind of back to the selfishness thing. It's like Doris was invented to help, to work together with a human. Mm-hmm. And instead, Doris was like, no, I'm going to take the human and I'm going to do whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I think that Doris is like the darkest version of what Lewis could have been.
It's the darkest timeline.
It's yeah, it really is the darkest timeline.
It literally becomes the darkest timeline.
Yeah. I love the design, by the way, of the dystopian timeline.
Everything is a bowler hat.
I love, like, bravo to the art department, whoever came up with all the character designs and all the background design. Like, that is just so good. So good. Artistically, that's my favorite part of the movie. I love a good dystopia, and I love how cohesive and interesting that one is.
And the music and the effects of Wilbur fading from existence.
Oh, that's like a Spider-Man in Endgame kind of thing.
Lewis, I don't feel so good.
Yeah, it's just like so harsh. But I do like using the same trick against Doris.
Yeah, I will never invent you. And
yeah, I've decided that I now know what this is leading to, and I won't do it. You would have thought that would have worked in Terminator, but they kept finding ways for it not to.
I mean, that's kind of the crux of the Terminator. Someone says, well, I'm not going to invent the Terminator. And then someone says, well, why don't we invent Terminators?
Yeah. But in this reality, apparently Lewis is the only person that can invent anything. He seems to be like the one tech daddy of the entire
human
race.
Everyone is using his technology. We see that,
yeah.
Wilbur Prima says that all the technology that the people use come from Robinson Technologies.
Yeah. Which you do see a staff at Robinson Technologies, but it's like, how much did those people really contribute? Because the movie doesn't seem to suggest they contributed
anything. That's kind of a monopoly there, Lewis.
Yeah. I mean, I got issues with that too, but it's a kid's movie, and you know, we had to explore other avenues, so yeah. I'll give it a pass on that one.
But I just love when Bowler Hat guy is telling his story, and his big plan for taking down Robinson Technologies is the egg building.
Yeah.
Robinson, yes,
and toilet paper it.
And TP it, yeah.
Yeah.
And in 2020, toilet paper is a very, very high valued commodity.
Yeah. Don't be wasting toilet paper on your enemies, folks. But yeah, I like the statement of, and we went with Doris's idea. It's such a good line, and it's so well delivered.
And Wilbur had actually locked the garage, and this whole movie would never have happened.
Yeah. So I like the idea that Lewis's first idea was to, like, once you've diffused the threat of Doris and Bowler Hat Guy and realizing that Doris was kind of the one controlling the situation, mm-hmm. is that his first idea was, let's have adult Goob be adopted by the Robinsons.
Yeah. After Wilbur kicked him in the junk.
Well, yeah. But, you know, fair. He did steal the time machine.
And did change the future.
And did change the future. And did remove Wilbur from the time stream for a while. So, yes. You know, fair. I'll give Wilbur that one. It's fine. But I like that that was...
I love... I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I love Wilbur... Lewis kind of taking charge. Like, I am your father, and you will do what I say.
Yeah. That's also a good dynamic. I like that. But I like that's the first inkling of we've got to make this right.
Yeah. Let's give Goob the family he never had.
Yeah, but I like the fact that the movie also realizes that maybe Goob has been through too much.
Yeah, and he just walks away. You see his binder with just a question mark on it. He has no idea what to do, especially since 30 years of his life, he has been planning the downfall of Lewis. And now that he's seen that it was wrong, he has no idea what he wants to do.
Yeah. And I like that moment of that you don't know what's going to become of Goob. Mm-hmm. And then I do like that it gets resolved later, you know, yeah. in the way we talked about before. But I do like that moment of, can you come back from that? And the movie seems to suggest that in that timeline, no, you can't.
Goob had gone too far in that, yeah.
You know, and I think it does play into the idea of, you know, you can't dwell on it too far because there comes a point where it's just only hurting you.
And there's also a point where there's no going back.
Yeah. You know, even as goofy as his egging and TPing of the Robinson building was, you realize that, like, you know, Goob is one guy. And even if you would consider his beef to be legitimate after 30 years, which is debatable and probably not, but even if you considered it legitimate, he has no power in that future. Mm-mm. The Robinson Corporation seems all-encompassing, and Goob is one guy who's had no further opportunity past the age of 12 throwing eggs at the monolith, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's such an interesting dynamic that they come up with for that of, like, what could he have done? Even if his rage were legitimate, he is one guy by himself. Now, if there had been a bunch of people that were mad at Lewis, maybe there could have been something. But, you know, one guy is not going to be able to do it on its own without the sort of deus ex machina of a time machine.
Yeah.
But at the same time, probably not a legitimate beef at that point.
Yeah.
Like, as the movie says, at some point, you know, you can hate that guy for the rest of your life, but also you've got to move on with your life.
That cannot be your life. Your life cannot be hating this one person. You can hate him, fine. You know, hate him. Despise his guts, but you have to still live your life.
And sometimes, and I wish the movie could have gotten into this more, but I realized that wasn't necessarily their focus. Mm-hmm. Is that sometimes living well is the best revenge?
Yeah.
You know, if he'd have gone back and been like, no, I'm going to devote my entire life to Little League and become like the most famous rich, you know, baseball player ever. And, you know, when I'm famous, I'm going to write a tell-all book of like how I succeeded despite Cornelius Robinson being a jerk or something. I don't know.
And when Cornelius Robinson comes to me for a sponsorship deal, I'll tell him no.
Yeah, exactly. You know, something like that, I think, would have been a more reasonable revenge, you know, if you want to call it that.
A realistic revenge.
Yeah, but also, you know, like, you can't stop your entire life. Mm-hmm. You know?
And that's what Goob did. He stopped his life at age 12 to just self-pity himself into a rage of hating Cornelius Robinson.
And I think that's what Lewis learns at the end with his mother. You know, he spends all this time of, like, I want to go back to my mother because I want to know why she left me. She ruined my life by leaving me. He has a similar beef with his mother that bowler hat guy has with young Lewis.
Yeah.
You did me wrong at this one point in my life, and everything else after that is awful because of you. And Lewis realizes, like, it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It is what it is. Maybe she was a horrible person. Maybe she did it because she knew he might have a better chance at life without her.
Maybe it's a situation like in Shazam.
Yeah, maybe it's something, you know, we don't know how old his mother was. We don't know the circumstances of his mother. We don't know if there was a father in the picture. We assume not.
And that's part of the thing. We don't know, and we're never going to know, and we're not supposed to know.
Actually, I wanted to point out somebody, I forgot, I don't know who posted this originally, but so at the end of the movie, or near the end of the movie, future Lewis tells young Lewis, Cornelius tells young Lewis, like, because Lewis has, you know, do I ever see my mother? And he's like, well, you're just going to have to wait and find out. And then at the science fair, they show, grandma's wedding day, and Mildred is there. And then there's another woman in that shot in the memory. And if you look at the, you know, design, if you put that design of that woman next to the woman that drops off the baby at the orphanage, and they seem like they're the same. So if that woman was Lewis's mother, then technically Lewis did see his mother.
Huh.
So, you know, I, that's just someone fan theory. I would not say that's canon, but that
it
is.
It could just, we're just going to reuse this model in the background.
Yeah. So
who knows? I mean, we don't know what the intention was, and we'll probably never know.
Yeah, but I do like, I think one of the things I like about Lewis deciding not to go confront his mother is I think it would have sent the wrong message to any adopted kids that watched the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the things that resonated with Stephanie and how it related to, you know, her and her brother is that it's like this is the way life has unfolded, and to obsess about, you know, what had happened before, was in a lot of cases just, you know, doesn't, you know, it isn't going to help you build a better future for yourself. So, yeah.
Yeah, but also we get the thing from the woman at the orphanage where she says, we don't know why your mother gave you up, but it doesn't necessarily mean that she had bad intention for you.
Yeah.
And I think that most people who give a child up for adoption do it because they want a better life for that child.
And of course, you know, Lewis misunderstands that completely because he's a kid and he's still obsessed over it. But you're right, you know, it's...
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Anyone could say, you know, the mother wanted a better life for Lewis. And we don't even know if Lewis was his birth name or not, because I don't see a birth certificate in that box.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that... I had just read, you know, you're talking about people who give up for adoption, but I had just read recently about Kate Mulgrew, who we spoke of before in Gargoyles, and most famously played Captain Janeway on Voyager. And when she was starting her acting career, she became pregnant and realized that her life could not give that baby the life that she wanted that baby to have. she wanted that child to have, you know, a different life and hopefully a better life than she could give it. And so she gave up her first daughter for adoption. And apparently it does seem that the daughter had a pretty good life. And when she was an adult, she came searching for her birth mother just to reconnect. But not necessarily out of any sort of, you know, ill intent from what I can tell. I haven't read the entire story. But it does really humanize that, you know, some people just aren't in the right place at the right time. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're bad people for doing that. And I think to have Lewis confront his mother at that age, it would have sent the wrong kind of message about why a lot of children end up in the adoption system. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily that they're wanted, but that most of the time the parents are trying to give them a better future. And I think that's a better message to send, not only to kids in the system, or kids who have been adopted, but also just normal kids. Because, you know, when we were growing up, you know that we made fun of, we in the general societal sense, made fun of the kids that were adopted.
Kids are mean. Kids are cruel.
Yeah, and I think anything that teaches kids to empathize with other people is amazing. And I think this movie did a good job of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a lot of ways, which I really respect.
And it's, you know, we mentioned before, and it's right there, you know, after deciding that he's not, you know, he doesn't need to meet his mother in a way he kind of understands. He actually ends up meeting for his adopted mother. His adopted parents are right there at the science fair.
Yeah. And who, it seems, are the most loving and wonderful parents and give him the exact life that he both wanted and needed.
Yeah.
You know, they're able to connect with him in the ways that he wants. You know, they're also into science. They want him to be his own kind of weird self and stuff. And some people luck into that by birth, and some people don't. But if you luck into it either way, what a blessed life that is.
Yeah, not everybody gets that. Even people, you know, most kids in this system never get that kind of life.
And so, you know, I like the idea of I can deal with my past because it's bringing me to a place I want to be.
Yeah.
Which I also think is a thing that most of us have to learn.
Yeah. You just can't stay obsessed with the past. You can't let whatever bad thing that happened to you in your past cannot define who you are.
Yeah. But also I think it's good in a societal sense. You know, that quote at the end of Disney, the full quote.
Yeah.
I think is really amazing of keep looking forward, keep looking for the next thing, keep looking for how you can evolve both personally and in general. Mm-hmm. Which
and
I think
that's
a
quote that the world really does need right now.
Yeah, and I do like that thing. So, do we want to ask the big question?
Is there magic in this movie? I'm going to say yes.
Yes.
I am also going to say yes. I think it's not a perfect movie. I think it stumbles a bit in some places, but I think it's also one of those that its heart is definitely in the right place, and I definitely think it deserved better than it's gotten.
Yeah. Like I said, I would consider this one of the hidden gems of the Walt Disney Animation collection.
Yeah, and we found a couple of those through this rewatch.
Yeah.
A few that we had kind of thought like, we might have written it off earlier, but we find that as adults, we can appreciate it more. And I think this is one of those that I'm not sure. I mean, granted, this came out in 2007, so we were all adults when it came out.
Yeah.
But I think if I'd have seen this as a kid, I might not have gotten it entirely. But I think as an adult, it hits a little more.
And I do like, you know, towards the end, Lewis is looking around and he sees the people that will become his adopted parents and the girl that will become his wife. And he's kind of smiling like, yeah, my future is going to be really bright.
Yeah. And honestly, I wish we could all have that sort of sneak peek
into your future. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just glad Bud decided not to drive the car backwards. He actually is facing forward and not using the face that painted on the back of his head to drive the car.
Yeah. I love the quirks that never get explained. Like, why is he constantly wearing his clothes backwards? We don't know, but apparently he's been doing it for 30 years. And
well, he says that
he's a nice enough sort.
Well, he says, it's explained that he's a teacher. He's a science teacher. And that he does it to kind of fool his students that his head's on backwards. And no one gets the joke. But he keeps on doing it because he thinks it's funny.
It's dad jokes.
Yeah. Hence the glasses on the dog.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I if I had thought about it ahead of time, I would have looked up, you know, other animated features from other studios that had come out around, you know, in 2007 and around that year, just to see like what was getting all the attention at that time, you know, that you know, for whatever reason had made Meet the Robinsons not get that attention that it deserved. In fact, that, because me and Stephanie, we, you know, every few years we'll go on, you know, we'll go to Disney World just because we like to go to Disney World together. It's one of the things we do well together. And so that movie came out, I believe, in March of 2007.
March of 2007.
Yeah. So by January of 2008, I believe it was, when we went to Disney World, you know, less than a year later, we were looking for, you know, like the Robinsons meet and greet characters or just any merchandise having to do with the film. And we could not find anything like that movie, like not even the pins that are part of the big pin collectors thing. It's like that movie came and went so quick that by the time we got there less than a year later, it was like that movie hadn't even existed. So
it does seem that right after this movie came out, the next big thing, especially for Disney, was Ratatouille.
I can see it. And that was the same year Enchanted came out. The B movie came out that year.
Yeah, like jazz. Shrek the Third, which was not a great movie.
The Simpsons movie.
Yeah. But, you know, it had a lot of competition.
Yeah. The first Alvin and the Chipmunks movie.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, you know, I think it just Ratatouille kind of overshadowed it. Or Enchanted, if you want to go in that direction.
Yeah, maybe. But I don't know. I think it's worth a watch if you haven't seen it, or a rewatch if you haven't seen it in a while. Definitely go check it out. If nothing else, it is a beautiful film. Again, I was really shocked by how good it looks in
the
like
animation holds
modern.
Up. For a 15-plus-year-old movie, that the animation is still beautiful.
Yeah, and like I said, I watched it in, like, Ultra HD 4K kind of resolution. It's still beautiful.
There's, like, okay, I want to say this before we sign off. There's two great classic movie references during the dinner scene. The grandpa, you know, Grandpa Bud doing the little Charlie Chaplin fork dance. And a straight-up Japanese dub action scene.
Yeah, that's a really good kind of fight scene that comes out of nowhere. It's just...
And you know, Lewis is saying, is this normal? Well, no, yesterday we had meatloaf.
Yeah. So I do love it.
Making a commercial, like shortening that to whatever 30 seconds, making that a commercial for the movie would have been great. Like,
and you thought your family was weird.
Yeah. So Why don't we go to maybe Luke telling people where they might find him elsewhere?
Sure. You can find me on the internet. Most of the places, my handle is The Great Luke Ski, which is all is one word. My website for my comedy music is lukeski.bandcamp.com. And if you go there, I believe it is my album, which is titled Target Audience, is the one that has the song Wilbur Robinson on it, so you can hear that for free. You can also hear that for free over at thefump.com, which stands for the Funny Music Project, thefump.com. And I also am a storyboard artist who is looking for work, either freelance or full-time, whatever. I can work from home. You can see my portfolio of that work up at www.luke.ski. I think that's...
And you're also on a podcast that we keep talking about.
Oh, yes. The aforementioned guest of this show, Kyle Carroza, and also appearing quite often on the show is his wife, Lindsay. There's a podcast we've been doing since 2013 called Kyle and Luke Talk About Tunes, which comes out every 2 weeks on Sunday. And we just talk about whatever is going on in the world of animation. A recent episode is we did our review of Solar Opposites, a show that you have reviewed. Lindsay gave us a lot of behind the scenes stuff on that because she was one of the character designers of this series up till now. And once the series premiered, they promoted her to lead character designer. So Lindsay is doing quite excellently and good on
getting
her.
Getting that Disney money.
Yep. Kyle and Luke Talk About Tunes. Just search for us on Facebook to find our Facebook group. And our the website where you can officially hear the feed is kyleandluke.com. Just go there. We're part of the OG networks. So go there and click on shows and you'll find the list of shows where you can listen to them and download them. And it's a fun time. And this coming episode, we've already recorded either the majority of it or all of it, depending on what Kyle decides. Back in December, I did a special episode with a couple friends of mine named Brianna and Kit, who are fans of She-Ra and the Princesses of Power. And we talked about the first four seasons once season four had just come out. And now season five came out, which is the series finale season. So I recorded another episode with the two of them and also their friend Jimmy Sherfy, who cosplays as She-Ra and Catra and stuff. And we just talked all about, you know, season five and the finale and the whole series and, you know, how much we love it. So that is going to be the majority of, if not all of, the next episode of Kyle and Luke Talk About Tunes. But we talk about TV shows, movies, you know, CG, hand-drawn, you know, stop motion. We even talk about Muppets once in a while because it's our show and we will, dang it. So, Kyle and Luke Talk About Tunes. Check it out, yo.
All right, and one final thing we have to do is what we're doing next week, which Luke gets a guest request because this is the first time you've ever co-hosted our show. So what do you got? What are we doing next week?
Well, I would like to ask you very much, would you please watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
We can do that.
That would be our great pleasure.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Hey, this is me editing the very podcast you're listening to. After recording this one, we decided that now may not be the right time to talk about Roger Rabbit. So, we will be talking about it in a few weeks, but there's something else we want to talk about next week. And next week will be a very special episode, and we hope that you will enjoy what we come up with. And then we'll be talking about Roger Rabbit sometime after that. Thank you.
Now, back to our show.
All right, so that's all we can talk about, all that so far. So, check us out on Facebook. Check us out on Twitter. Rewatch the Magic on Twitter. Rewatching the Magic on Facebook. We are always looking for your feedback and requests and conversations. We're all looking forward to that. Check us out on iTunes. Give us a review. It would really help us out. We are also on Spotify. Check us out there.
And check out work for Rewatching the Magic, because there's artwork.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
The artwork that we have for our podcast was made by Luke.
Yeah. And also go to loganawards.com and tell us what your favorite comedy music of 2019 was. And thank you.
Bye!
Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.